Okay, so what I'd like to talk about today is a sort of a new... Okay, so for the rest of the semester, I wanted to switch gears a little bit. And it's talking about... I wanted to talk about a, a really, I think, kind of an amazing idea in, associated with algorithms, okay, or about, in fact, really associated with the fact that you can sort of show... For many problems, we've seen a lot of problems for which there are efficient algorithms, okay? We've seen several problems for which we couldn't find efficient algorithms. And what we'd like is something stronger. We would like to be able to sort of argue about whether or not there really is an efficient algorithm, even if we can't find it. Okay, so you can sort of imagine the classic example is the following. Suppose some of you graduate from here, that's likely. Some of you go on to get jobs, that is also reasonably likely. Okay? And some of you, when you go to work, will be charged with finding an algorithm, efficient algorithm for a problem. Okay? Also reasonably likely. Okay? And suppose, let's say, you think about it and you cannot find an algorithm to solve this problem, such that the worst case time is efficient, polynomial, and it always gives you the right answer. What do you do at this point? I claim there's sort of a couple of possibilities. One possibility is you go back to your boss and you say, I cannot find an efficient algorithm. I guess I'm too dumb. Okay? What is bad about that possibility, about that situation?
You get fired. Yeah.
You get fired, okay? So now what would be much better to say would be if you go to the boss and come back and assertively state, I cannot find an efficient algorithm because no such algorithm is possible. Okay? Then, you're sort of on top. You're asking me to do something. I've proven to you it is impossible. Okay? That would be very good, except I can tell you that there is no non-trivial problems I can think of. Okay? I mean, again, it's the exact details are complicated. It's extremely hard to prove a lower bound on a problem. To prove that absolutely there is no way to do this problem in polynomial time. Okay? I'll tell you that there is no techniques that I know for doing that. So I don't see how you're going to be able to go back to the boss and do this. But what the theory of NP completeness proof does is give us some almost as good a guarantee. It lets you go back to the boss and say, I can't find this efficient algorithm, an efficient algorithm for my problem. But Skeena, he can't do it either. Robert Dargin, he can't do it. And Donald Knuth can't do it. Okay? And every famous person in the world can't solve your problem. Okay? Why is this a good thing? Well, first of all, you were worried about getting fired. Okay? If you can prove to the boss that nobody else can do the problem, then it doesn't pay for the boss to fire you, right? Okay? So it saves your job. But more than that, this is a reasonably strong guarantee. Okay? It's not a perfect guarantee. It's possible that someone will come along later and come up with a better way to do your problem. Okay? To prove that, in fact, there is a way to do it. But what the theory of NP completeness does is give you a very, very strong guarantee that the problem cannot be, cannot be solved efficiently. Okay? And as far as I'm concerned, it's as good as a lower bound proof. It's not really a lower bound proof. Okay? But unless you want to be academic, to my sense of things, once you prove a problem is NP complete, you have a darn good reason for believing the problem does not have a polynomial time solution. Okay? So this is really, if you stop and think about it, though, arguing, how would you try to prove that a bunch of famous people couldn't solve your problem? Can someone give me a way of doing that? Yeah.
Well, if you could bring it down to a generic form that, these people have tried to solve it.
So now that's exactly the idea. Okay, well, what I was hoping you were saying is you pay, the first thing you might say is, well, why do you go pay money to these people if they try to solve it, okay, if you can't do it? But that's expensive and you can't always get to that. But a much better idea is what you're saying here is what if we could convert your problem into a problem that famous people have already thought about? Okay? You have a particular problem you want to work on. Okay? Your boss gave it to you. It's not clear anybody, it's of interest to anybody else except your boss. Okay, so nobody else may have thought about your particular problem. But if you can find a way to take the boss's problem and convert it into such a way that you can show that it's related to a problem other people have thought about and failed to solve. Then you can prove that these people would fail to solve your problem. That is exactly the line of reasoning that we want to do. Okay, maybe we should discuss that again informally right now. Basically, suppose I take your problem that you're interested in and show how to convert it into a problem such that the famous people have thought about and failed. If solving your problem means solving the problem the famous people have thought about, then if the famous people can't solve it, they can't solve your problem. That is exactly the line of reasoning that we're going to be looking at. We're going to use some notation and it's going to become more formal, but make sure you understand that. Any questions about that line of reasoning? Okay? We don't yet see how do we do that transformation, but that's exactly what we're going to be doing. Any questions? Okay? So what the theory of empty completeness does is give us a way to show that problems are basically, all the hard problems are basically the same thing. Okay? And so, for example, we know the traveling salesman problem we looked at. Okay? No one knows a fast algorithm for the traveling salesman problem. We also looked at, I guess, the max cut problem, right? I told you wouldn't find a fast algorithm for max cut. Why was that? Because I could show that max cut is really the same thing as the traveling salesman problem. And the traveling salesman problem is really the same thing as max cut. And all these other problems famous people can't solve. So if you could solve one of them, you would basically have to solve them all. Okay? And that's sort of the power of NP completeness. Okay? That all the problems we don't know how to solve, and all, not quite all of them, but a large set of interesting problems, okay, are all really the same problem at heart. Okay? And that's really what we have to show. Any questions? So what I find from past years when I talk about the theory of NP completeness is it's something that there's things we've talked about in here, like dynamic programming, which many of you don't understand after having it been taught. I know this. I haven't seen the midterm, but I'll assume that that's true. Okay? I tell you that's fundamentally easy. You tell me you don't understand it, which I understand why. But you get frustrated. You probably don't like dynamic programming. Theory of NP completeness is a hard subject, but I find that it's actually a very interesting subject. It's something that students somehow, I have found when I thought about it, people may be confused, but they're very impressed by it, okay? So I hope you'll find this interesting, okay? Because if you think about it, what we're trying to do is really an amazing thing. We're trying to prove that a problem does not have a fast solution, okay? Proving it has a fast solution seems like it should be obvious, okay? I mean, did you show me a fast way to do it? Yeah, there's a fast way to do it. How do you prove a negative that there is no such thing? That seems like an impossibility. Okay, but the theory of entropy completeness gives us a way to do it. And once you understand that, it's really an amazing and satisfying thing. Okay, and so I hope people will kind of get a feeling for the flavor of it and how you use it and stuff like that. Any questions? Okay.
So, why do we care? Is the first question. And this now is probably clear to you from the after you did the max cut experiment. We looked at, if you draw a plot, we talk about big O time complexities, okay? You know, there's some problems that we've seen are order n squared, maybe order n cubed. We've probably not seen any interesting algorithms more than n cubed. We saw that enumerating all subsets was 2 to the n, like you did in max cut. All permutations would be n factorial, like you would do in traveling salesmen. And the point is that when you hit, if you take a look as n goes larger and larger, how large a problem do you need before it starts to become impossible to solve in a reasonable amount of time? Well, when you talk about, let's say you can solve, I don't remember exactly what this table says, let's say you can do 1,000,000 operations per second. For n equals 1,000, you could certainly hope to do a quadratic algorithm on it. You could hope to do a cubic algorithm on it. But if you plot the function 2 to the n, the number of millionths of seconds you get
By the time you had N equals 100, you're talking about, you know, 10 to the 13th years to solve that, okay? So there, whereas when you talk about, you know, polynomial time algorithms, problems of size 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 are perfectly doable. So there is a big difference between an exponential time problem and a polynomial time problem. We say a problem is polynomial time if you can do it, if there is an algorithm that runs in n to the c for some c, okay, and squared and cubed and fifth. We say a problem is exponential if it takes basically at least some constant to the n time, okay? And there's a big difference here. And so what really the theory of NP completeness does, it gives us a way to classify our problems, okay? Is it doomed to being in here no matter what you do? Or, you know, basically if you have a fast algorithm, you can prove that it's in this category. Basically, what theory of NP completeness will do will enable us to take a problem and argue that there's no faster way than doing it like this. Okay? And as you can see, the implications are quite dramatic as far as how you solve it. Okay? If your problem is NP complete and you have a large input instance, you cannot hope to solve it exactly. Okay? That's got to be what you've got to think. You've got to think of other ways to deal with it. But that's just not going to happen. Any questions? Okay? That's sort of the basic idea. Let me, before I tell you the real technical idea behind NP completeness, let's realize we're going to have to work in a somewhat more abstract way than we've been talking about. Well, not even a little bit more. Before, we were talking about the specific kind of algorithm problems. Okay? We were talking about problems. What was an algorithm problem? Shortest path. You took his input, a graph, and said, find me the shortest path. So when we talk about problems, again, this is really the same way we talked about problems before. We describe a problem as a general question, and a problem instance being the specific data that you assign to a specific problem. Okay? So it's important to see that there is a distinction between what we mean by a problem. Okay, so for example, traveling salesman is a problem. Okay? A problem is characterized by a question. Okay? And a set of sort of data formats that you will accept as input to that question. So the traveling salesman question is a problem because it takes his input, it says, the input is a weighted graph, and the output is a tour, a permutation of the vertices of that graph that minimizes the sum of the edges you walk over. Okay? A problem instance would be a graph, a specific graph, like this one. Okay? And so to solve the problem itself, the problem in a particular instance, you get an answer here. Okay? Does everybody see that there's a distinction here between the higher level abstract notion of a problem and a specific input instance? Any questions about that? Okay? When we say a problem does not have any fast algorithm, we're talking about the abstract problem. We're saying that traveling salesman does not have a fast algorithm. That doesn't mean for a particular input, it's not easy to find the right answer. Okay? Suppose I give you the following graph on a million vertices, where all it is one cycle. Here's a million vertex graph. Okay? What is this, the optimal traveling salesman tour in this graph? Does anyone want to suggest? Okay? Does anyone know how to find it? Yeah, I see people going like this. Okay? There is only one tour, right? So saying even though the traveling salesman problem is in general hard and in general exponential, of course there can be simple instances which can be solved efficiently, right? Does everybody agree with that? There's no mystery about the fact that it's easy to construct an easy enough instance. Okay? We're going to be interested in the general problem, which basically describes all instances.
Okay? So if I prove a problem is NP-complete, okay, or exponential, that means that there are some instances, no matter what algorithm you give me, some instances which that one will essentially take exponential time. Again, I'm playing a little bit loose with some things, but maybe we'll get into some of the technical details later. Okay? But any questions about that? Okay? So when I talk about problem, I mean an abstract problem. Okay? And an instance is an actual, basically, input to a problem. Any questions? Okay? We are going to limit, when we talk about the theory of NP-completeness, we're going to be talking about a special type of problem called a decision problem. We're only going to be interested in problems which have yes or no answers. Okay? So I don't know how to prove things about the traveling salesman problem. Okay, in general, does the traveling salesman problem have a yes or no answer? No, it has a numerical answer, right? Is there a way I can come up with a problem that has a yes or no answer that basically captures what the traveling salesman problem is? Okay? Yeah? Well, what I'm looking for is something like the following. Suppose, let's say, I consider the following problem. Given a weighted graph G and an integer K, does there exist a traveling salesman tour with cost less than K? Is that a yes or no question? Okay. Does that really capture the hardness, what makes the traveling salesman problem interesting, even though it's only yes or no? I claim it does. Suppose I gave you a fast algorithm for answering this question. Could you solve the traveling salesman problem? Suppose I gave you this magic box, okay, who if given a graph, any graph and any integer, would answer yes or no, does that graph have a traveling salesman tour of cost less than K? Would that be useful to find traveling salesmen? How? How would you use it? Yeah? Right. So if suppose, let's say, I wanted to find out the traveling salesman cost, I could find out, start with the sum of all the weights of the edges, right? Clearly, the optimal traveling salesman tour is less than that, right? Because you don't have to visit all the edges. If there is a tour, it's going to be less than the sum of all the edges, right? So I have an upper bound on the tour, and zero is a lower bound on the tour, right? Suppose I go look in the middle, and I say, hey, is there a tour of at least this big? If there is a tour that is less than this, then I'll look over here. I can do a binary search, for example, to find the exact value of the optimal tour. Does everybody agree with that? So I claim that by adding this sort of integer here, I get a way to convert almost any real problem into an interesting decision problem. Okay, and so if I prove to you that the traveling salesman decision problem is hard, you should believe me that the general traveling salesman problem is hard. Does everybody sort of buy that logic? Any questions about that? Okay. So we're going to, in general, be interested in yes or no problems, decision problems. Any questions? Okay. Fair enough. There's some technical details. I don't want to really go into that. But what is the main idea? This one slide is the entire idea of NP completeness. Okay? If you understand this slide, you can do, in principle, do everything. Everything else is mechanics after this. Okay? What is the idea of this thing? Suppose I give you the following algorithm to solve the Bandersnatch problem. What is the Bandersnatch problem? Whatever problem you're interested in. Okay? Bandersnatch is just a name for a problem. Okay? Nothing special about it. Okay? You can substitute traveling salesmen, substitute max cut, you can substitute whatever problem you want. Okay?
Consider the following algorithm for solving Bandersnatch on an input G. What I'm going to do is translate my input for G into the input for the Bobilli problem. What is the Bobilli problem? It's just another problem. Maybe it's max cut, maybe it's shortest path, maybe it's sorting, maybe it's whatever. Okay? I'm now going to call a subroutine for solving the Bobilli problem on my translated instance. Okay? And I am going to return the answer of Bobilli on the translated instance as the answer to my problem. Okay? This is an algorithm. Okay? That's the important thing to see here. And it makes use of a subroutine for solving something called the Bobilli problem. Okay? Again, you know, it's just the name of a problem. Okay? And how does the algorithm work? It starts by taking the input to the problem you want to solve, translates it to the, so it's the input of the Bobilli problem, and then returns the answer of the Bobilli problem as the answer to the original problem. Okay? Under what condition would this algorithm be correct? Let's think about it. Under what condition would this algorithm be correct for solving the Bandersnatch problem on G? Yeah? Well, yeah, you have to, not only that you have to convert Bandersnatch into Bobilli, that's true, but you also need the answer to the Bobilli problem on the translated instance to be the same as the answer of Bandersnatch on G. Okay? If that's true, then this is a correct algorithm. Okay? Let's think about this. Okay? So people wandering a little bit. Okay? But so what happens? Suppose, let's say, I mean, I will show you examples of how you do this later on, but it's important to understand the basic flow of the reasoning. Suppose I can give you a translation of Bandersnatch on G to Bobilli of Y, such that the answer of Bobilli of Y is the exact same as the answer of Bandersnatch of G. Okay? And since these are decision problems, that means that whatever Bandersnatch of G is true, Bobilli of Y is true. Okay? And whenever Bandersnatch of G is false, Bobilli of Y is false. Okay? If I can do that translation, does everybody see that this is a correct algorithm for solving Bandersnatch? Okay? How many people see that? How many people do not see that? Okay, any questions? Do not see that. Raise your hand. Okay? So what does this give us to us? So we call any kind of a translation of the instances of one problem to the instances of another, such that the answers are preserved. That's what we call a reduction. Okay? So the reduction is this step over here. Okay? Now, suppose my translation from G to Y takes order Pn times, where n is the size of the input. Let's think what this subroutine means. I claim it means two different things. One is, if I have a Bobilli routine that runs in order P prime n, this means I can solve Bandersnatch in order Pn plus B prime n. Does everybody agree with that? Why is it that if my Bobilli subroutine runs this fast, this gives me a Bandersnatch solution in this time? Why is that? What? So based on the time it will take to solve my problem, the answer to this is the same as the answer to that. It will take me Pn times n time to do this step. It'll take me P prime n to do that. How much time does it take to return true and false? Well, order one, right? So if, in fact, the subroutine runs this fast, this gives me this kind of an algorithm, right? That's the analysis of the complexity of that algorithm, right? Yes?
Is there no case where you can then decide
vulnerability and then you solve it and you have to convert the answer back? Well, okay, if I have done it in this... See, one thing that's nice is, if the answer is always true or false, converting back is pretty easy. Usually the answer you'll convert back is just the same answer. What can you do? You can either take the answer or you can complement it. So, for our purposes, we're going to insist that the answer be the same. Okay, you could imagine there also being a translation step here, but it turns out we can make the translation step be part of the initial translation, so I'm not going to worry about that. Any questions? But what's the other implication of this subroutine? And this is really the interesting part. Suppose I know that omega p prime n is a lower bound for Bandersnatch. Suppose I know that there is no possible way to compute Bandersnatch in less than p prime n time. Okay? Absolutely no, not. I tell you, I have a proof. God has told me Bandersnatch cannot be computed faster than this. What does this algorithm tell me about vulnerability? Okay? I know the translation can be done in p prime n, okay? Because I've told you this thing. I claim that if this is a lower bound for Bandersnatch, this minus the translation time has to be a lower bound on the time it takes to compute vulnerability. Why is that? Yeah?
Because if vulnerability can be computed in lower time, then their combined sum will be less than the lower bound, which can't be.
That's exactly right, okay? Suppose, let's say, in fact, there was a faster way to compute vulnerability than this. Then what does that mean? The translation time plus this is less than the time God told me was necessary to do this, right? So what are you saying? If there's a faster way to do this, God was lying to me. Okay, and that doesn't happen. Okay, not if you have a lower bound here, right? So this is the amazing thing. If I know a lower bound on the time it takes, that it takes at least this long for this algorithm to run, then that any way to solve Bandersnatch takes at least this much time, then I claim this algorithm gives me a way to prove that vulnerability also has to take a lot of time. Right? Everybody agree with that? This is the trick that we're going to use. We're going to start out with one problem that we know takes exponential time. We're then going to give you you're then going to come up with, for a problem that you think is hard, you're going to write this subroutine, okay, to solve your problem, okay, the hard problem in terms of mobility, in terms of your interesting problem. The problem you're interested in is mobility. If you can do that, your problem is hard, because an easy solution to your problem coupled with your algorithm gives you an easy way to do the problem we know can't be done quickly. Any questions? That is the reasoning that we're going to be using. That's the entire reasoning here. Okay, and if you think about it, it's very clever. Yes?
So one thing we have to keep in mind maybe is that our translation step has to be of lower complexity maybe.
Right, so if you tell me, look, I can translate this into that, but my translation takes exponential time. I'm not impressed by your translation. Okay, your translation doesn't do any good. For this lower argument to be interesting, you have to show me not only a translation, but a fast translation. A polynomial time translation and an exponential lower bound here gives you an exponential lower bound for the one you're interested in. Okay? And we will show that, in fact, our translations are going to be fast. You're right, you have to have a fast translation. But fast by us means polynomial, right? Suppose my translation took n to the 100th time. Is that fast?
It's fast enough. Okay? What if 2 to the n? I proved that Bandersnatch takes at least 2 to the n. And my other algorithm, and my translation takes n to the 100. What is 2 to the n minus n to the 100 in big O y's? 2 to the n, right? This doesn't make a dent in it. Okay? So long as my translation can be n to the anything, okay, an exponential lower bound here is enough to prove an exponential lower bound here. So I got a lot of slop to play with when I say fast. Okay? Any questions? Any questions about this reasoning? Okay? The interesting argument is this idea here that if I have a lower bound here, you construct a subroutine. Okay? In fact, you can now find that gives you a lower bound on this. Any questions? Okay? Good. Let's look at an example of this reduction idea. So for right now, you're probably, and people's eyes are glazing a little bit, you can't imagine what I mean by a translation. Let me show you a translation between one problem you know and one problem you might have heard of. Okay? They're not exponential time problems, just to give you an idea of the reduction. Okay? So, you've probably heard of the problem of sorting numbers, right? That problem we've dealt with in here. Everybody here should know about the problem of given n numbers, sort them. Right? How fast can you do it? What's the fastest algorithm we saw in general for sorting n numbers? Heap sort n log n, right? I don't remember, did we prove that n log n was a lower bound, that there was no way to do better? I don't think we actually covered that this semester. But in fact, there's a very reasonable argument that there is no way to sort faster than n log n in the worst case, okay? There's another problem that's a very important problem in computational geometry, okay, called convex hull. Convex hull takes as input a set of points. And as output, finds the smallest polygon that contains all those points. Okay? How might you do this? But what if these points were stuck as nails in the heads of nails? You had the points were nails partially banged into a piece of wood. And suppose you stretch a rubber band over it and let go. What's going to happen to that rubber band? Ka-chung, it's going to go try to squash as tight as it can if it's a reasonable rubber band, right? Yes? The problem is to minimize the area of the convex polygon that contains all the points, right? What do I mean by a convex polygon? A convex polygon is one where every 2 points in the polygon, if you drew a line between them, that entire line is in the polygon. Okay, is this thing a convex polygon? No, why not? Because look, you can take these 2 points. But if you had 4 nails sticking out of the blackboard, and you stretch a rubber band over it, can the rubber band bend in here and pick off that? No, the rubber band is going to pick the smallest convex polygon that contains it, right? So convex hull is an important problem in geometry, okay? Let's leave it at that. It's probably one of the most important basic geometry problems. Now, what am I going to do? I'm going to show you a reduction which translates the problem of sorting numbers into a convex hull problem. Okay? What is the input to a problem of sorting numbers? It's a list of numbers, right? What is the input to the convex hull problem? A point set of points, right? Points are pairs of numbers, right? And it's going to try to find the ordering of the points on on the boundary of the convex hull. That's what the convex hull problem does. Suppose I took the numbers. Let's say you wanted to sort the numbers 7, 3, 5. What other numbers do you want to sort? Let's try 1, 9. Let me show you a way to sort them using convex hull. What did I do? I'm going to map every point to the point S and itself squared. That's 3, 9, 5, 25, 1, 1, 9, 81. What happens if I plot these points? For point 1, it's going to be down here. For point 3, it's going to be over here. For point 5, it's going to be up here. What other points do I have? 7 and 9. It's going to be up here and up here. What is the convex hull of those points going to look like? Is there going to be any points not on the hull? I claim, and this is probably requires a little bit of a proof. If you look at it, I claim that every point is going to be on the convex hull. Why is that? Because the square function grows pretty fast, right? So, if you look at it, it looks like the two smallest points. Will the third point, for the next x coordinate, will that be above or below this line? Has to be above the line, right? Because a larger number squared is going to be bigger, right? So with that kind of an argument, the convex hull is going to contain every single point. Does everybody sort of agree? If you don't believe the monotonicity argument, you can trust me on this. But what's interesting? Suppose you didn't have a subroutine to sort, but you did have a subroutine to compute convex hull. Could you use it to sort the numbers? I claim you could. What do? You take your numbers, convert them to points. Solve the convex hull on those points. Walk through the list of points on there. Find the smallest one with the smallest x coordinate. And now walk through each point to its neighbor and delete the second coordinate, right? The first point here is 1 something or other. Okay, the first thing in sorted order is 1. Second point is 3, so second next one's 3, 5, 7, 9. I claim I have just shown you a way to use a convex hull routine to sort. Does everybody agree with that? How many people sort of see what I'm doing? How many people are baffled and wanted a better explanation? Some people. Good. What have I done? I've just written the following algorithm, okay, for sorting. So in order to sort, what am I going to do? Sort a set of points S. My first algorithm is going to be 4i equals 1, 2, n. Point B sub I is going to be equal to S sub I squared. Okay? And now I've got a set of points. Right? I now call convex hull on P1 dot 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 Pn. And that's now going to, for these points, compute the convex hull. Ka-chunk, 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 ka-chunk. And now, strip away the y coordinates. So basically, since they return the x coordinates along the hull. I claim I have just developed a sorting algorithm. Okay? Why does it work? It works because of this funny property that because these points are drawn from the line y equals x squared,
the order of them on the hull is going to be exactly equal to the order of them, of their x-coordinate. Does everybody agree with that? That if you take the convex hull, how are you going to connect those points? Is there any way the convex hull of these points could be chung, 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 chung? Well, no, it's not going to be a convex polygon, is it? It's not going to be a polygon at all. So look what's happening. I happen to know that because of how I constructed these points, the convex hull is going to list all the points in sorted order. And so if I strip away the y-coordinates and just print out the x-coordinates, I will print those points in sorted order, provided I start from the right point. Okay? Any questions about that? Yes? Assuming I don't have doubles of the same x-coordinate, what's going to happen if I have two x-coordinates? Then you're right, that I've got multiple occurrences of it. Let's say the points have to be, the integers have to be distinct, for simplicity. Okay, so let's say that I'm sorting distinct integers. Okay, yes?
In order to step from one place, you have to sort it according
to start from the right place, once you give me the convex hull, maybe it's going to be some list of points starting from someplace. Tell me what the next one is. I say that in linear time, I can walk through the thing to find what was the leftmost low point. Find your leftmost point is not a hard thing, is it? You can solve the leftmost point in the order n time, right? Yeah. Well, I don't know how to sort, okay? I didn't take the beginning part of the class, but I happen to have this convex hull routine around. So notice what the convex hull can do, lots of different things, okay? I mean, given a bunch of points like this. It will find the face, right? It will find the outer part of the face, right? So convex hull can do a lot more general things. But what I've just proven is among the things the convex hull can do, if you feed it the right input, it can sort. Like it's a special case of what you can do with it, right? Does everybody agree with that? So if you were trapped on a desert island without a sorting routine, but with a convex hull program, you could sort to your heart's content. Any questions? Okay? Yes?
So one of the reasons that this convex hull routine works is because of the specific set of like non-negative numbers that we use. I mean, so that when the rubber band effect in turn actually happens, there's in fact nothing within the convex hull that actually is not covered on the rubber
band. Right, so you're saying that the only reason this worked is that when I did the translation, I was smart enough to do the translation so that all points appeared on the convex hull, right? And that in fact they all appeared on the lower end of the convex hull, and then eventually it wrapped back to the beginning. Okay? But notice I'm doing the translation here. Okay, it wasn't like I was given this as input. I was given this as input. And so given any set of numbers, I found a way to translate it such that all the points were always convex, right? Wasn't that hard. Okay? So any questions about this? Any more questions about this example? Well, what does this example mean? Okay? How much time does it take to translate each point integer to a point? If I have n integers, how much time is this step going to take? Order n? How much time will it take to return the x-coordinates of all the points? Once you give me the convex hull. Order n, right? What if I tell you, as if, and I might have, would have taught this to you in class if I had had, we hadn't been snowed out, I had an extra day or so. Suppose I tell you that sorting always takes n log n, which is true, okay? I mean, that's a truthful statement. Any reasonable algorithm in the book will prove that to you. Maybe mine, okay, I'm not sure, but any reasonable one will do it. Any questions? So what does that tell us? What does this subroutine tell us about convex hull? Convex hull, no matter how you do it, cannot be done faster than n log n time. Why? Suppose you could do convex hull in order n time. How fast could you sort? N. But I told you you can't sort in n log n time. So what does that mean about convex hull? You can't do it in n log n, in faster than n log n time. Does everybody agree with that? Yes? The existence of this thing written on the blackboard and my proof that sorting has to, that sorting in the worst case takes n log n time, this together is a perfectly rigorous proof that convex hull cannot be solved faster than n log n in the worst case. Okay? It doesn't prove that you can't do it in n log n time. Okay, I didn't show you how to do convex hull in n log n time. In fact, it happens to be possible, but that's irrelevant. But this proves that you can't do it any faster. Why? Because if you could do this faster, you could do this faster. And you can't do that faster. Okay? Therefore, you can't do this faster. Yes? Okay. So what you're telling me is, if my proof here is not sufficiently rigorous, then everything would break down. So if you tell me you don't believe this result, then I don't say anything, okay? If you tell me you don't believe this, then I give you nothing, okay? But if you believe the lower bound here, then the lower bound here is every bit as strong as the lower bound here. That's what it actually means, okay? Yes. Right. This is not proving the lower bound of sorting. This is proving the lower bound on convex hull. It's assuming a lower bound on sorting. Okay? So if we say hard here is n log n, we proved convex hull is as hard as sorting. That's really what we've done. Is that you can't only do convex hull faster than you can do sorting. Okay? Any questions? So which problem here is Bandersnatch and which problem is mobility? Let's take a quick look at this.
Okay, because this is one slide that has everything that we need to know. And we have to look at that slide carefully.
So in this particular example, what is being Bandersnatch? Sorting. And what is mobility? Convex hull. And what is my translation, my conversion? It is this. And what is my returning the answer? It is this. Okay? So this is a concrete example of the idea that we're using to prove lower bounds. We happen to be doing it on a problem that's pretty fast to begin with. And from now on, we'll just deal with exponential stuff. Okay? But does everybody see the logic of how we're proving we can't do this fast? Okay? Any questions? Okay? This problem we have proven is at least as hard as that one. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So this is the amazing idea, okay? And we're going to use this idea now to start to work on seriously hard problems. But any questions about this before we go on? This flow of reasoning, this flow of logic. Because I'm going to have to introduce to you some problems that you're not yet familiar with. Okay, so it might be, if you have any questions about the logic here, this might be a good first place to start. Any questions? Okay. So let's look at some problems. Let's look at what problem is going to be our Bandersnatch. Okay, so our Bandersnatch is, remember this problem that we said was very, very hard, right?
that we knew was hard. For this technique to work, we have to start with a problem that we know is hard. And what is the problem that is hard? Okay? It is going to be a problem called satisfiability. Okay? So it's a logic problem. Okay? But it's kind of an interesting logic problem. It says that the problem itself says you're given a bunch of Boolean variables and a bunch of clauses, logical clauses, over those variables. What do I mean by a clause? A clause is going to be something written as V1 or V2 or V3. Let's say dot, dot, dot. A clause is a bunch of logical variables that are ORed together, right? And so what I'm given here as input is a bunch of Boolean variables, let's say V1 through Vn, and I'm given a bunch of clauses, which are sets of specific variables, V1 or V2, not V2 or V5, or maybe V, not V3, or V1, or not V2. Okay, I'm giving you a set of clauses. And the satisfiability question says, is there a way to set those variables, true or false, so that all of the clauses are true? Okay? Any questions? Let's look at an example here. Suppose my set of variables are V1, V2, and I have two clauses on this. V1 or not V2, and not V1 or V2. Is there a way that I can set V1 and V2 to be either true or false, such that that expression is true? V1, V2. How can I set them so that both of these clauses are true? Suppose I set them equal to true, true. What does that mean? Is V1 is true or not true? Which is false, true. Is that true? Is not true or true, true? Yes. So there is a way to set them so they're both satisfied, right? Any questions? Is there another way to set them so that they're both satisfied? I said false or not false, which is true, or not false, which is true, or false, then in fact both of them stay true. Is there any other way to do it? They say true, false, true, or not false, which would be true, and not true or false is false. So those are the only two ways to do it. If both of them are true or both of them are false. Any questions? What about the following set of clauses? V1 or V2. V1 or not V2. Okay? Not V1. Is there any way that we can set those things to be true or false, such that all three of the clauses are true? But what do we know? Let's try to reason about it. V1 had better be false, right? So V1 we know has to be false or else this clause has no chance, right? If V1 is false, then what do we know about this one? V2 is true. No, V2, not V2 is true. That means that V2 is also false, right? And if V1 and V2 are false, is this thing satisfied?
So no matter how hard you try, you can't get no satisfaction. Okay, does everybody sort of agree with that? Okay? So this set of clauses cannot be satisfied. This set of clauses can be satisfied. Some can be, some can't be. And the algorithmic problem is, given as input a set of clauses, okay, is there a way to satisfy it? Okay, any question about that? Okay? This is the satisfiability problem. And this is the problem that we are going to declare is hard. Okay? That there is no known way to solve this problem efficiently. Okay? And it's not only just that Skinner and Thargent and all the other algorithms people thought about it and couldn't do it. If you actually study the theory of NP completeness in a, let's say, an automata theory class, you'll learn there's an even stronger reason to know that if you could solve this problem fast, you could solve all problems in a very, very large class fast. Basically, anything a Turing machine can do in polynomial time. Okay? So this problem is hard. If you can do this one, you can do everything. Okay? And therefore, we know you can't do this one. Okay? That's sort of our reasoning. Okay? Maybe you can do it. But if you could do this one, you could do everything. So you would become unbelievably famous if you find a way to do this problem. You know, there was this guy, I guess, who just was at Stony Brook math department the last, you know, any of you guys following the newspaper, there was a famous problem in topology supposedly solved recently, something called the Poincaré conjecture. This made the newspaper. I don't know if anybody heard this or anything like that. Okay? They're not reading the same newspaper as I am. But nonetheless, this guy solved this problem. He became famous. And he's actually speaking at Stony Brook on it sometime soon. So, you know, he was apparently a postdoc here or something like that, so he likes it. But if you could solve this problem, if you could find an efficient algorithm for satisfiability, I can guarantee you would be famous. You would be on the front page of the New York Times, and you would win a prize of $1 million, which is Math Institute offers. So there's quite good reason to believe you're not going to be able to do it, right? and more, but not only just you, but it's clear that there have been a lot of people trying and they can't do it, okay? So for various reasons, the sociological reasons that we've all tried and failed, and the more technical reasons about having to do with Turing machines and stuff like this, this problem we will accept as hard, okay? So satisfiability is a hard problem to do in general, okay? And we'll assume that that's the case. Okay, if you prove something is as hard as satisfiability, you have proven something important. Any questions? Okay? So we are going to use, we are going to use satisfiability as our bandersnatch. And now some other problem that we want to prove hard is going to be our mobility. Okay? Any questions? Let's look at a very, very special, let's look at a first mobility candidate. Okay? And this may not sound like that exciting a problem to you, but it's a special case of satisfiability called resatisfiability. Satisfiability, remember, was I gave you a set of clauses. And given a set of clauses, you had to find, was there a way to set the variables so you got at least one true in every clause, right? Now, suppose the clauses I gave you all had one variable in it. Okay? Suppose I give you a problem where the clauses I give you V1, V3, not V2, not V3. And so let's say these are my clauses. Can you give me an algorithm to solve satisfiability for the special case that every clause contains exactly one variable in it? Someone give me an algorithm to decide that question? Is it satisfiable if all the clauses have one variable in it? Yeah? Right. So look at this thing. This problem, you're going to tell me this problem is not satisfiable. Why? Because we said in order to satisfy this clause, V1 equals true. In order to satisfy this clause, V3 equals true. In order to satisfy this clause, V2 equals false. In order to satisfy this clause, V3 is false. And we've got a contradiction, right? So does everybody agree that satisfiability, if I give you clauses of size 1, that one is easy, right? So that special subset of satisfiability problems, those I can take pretty easily, right? In general satisfiability problems, how big can the clauses be? Well, infinite, I would say n. If there's n variables, it's probably not interesting to me once the clauses get longer than n, right? If I have a clause which has both V1 and not V1 in it, what do I know about that clause? It's obviously true. It's a tautology. If my clause has both V1 and not V1 in it, does it matter what I set V1 to? I get satisfied either way, right? So if you tell me I've got n distinct variables and my clauses are of length n minus 1, I say you're done. The answer is yes. You can satisfy it. But in general, the clauses can be very long. So we know the clauses of length n potentially. Clauses of length less than or equal to n. That problem is hard. Clauses of length equal to 1 is easy. What about clauses of size 3? I'm going to skip clauses of size 2. I will tell you, in fact, there is a polynomial time algorithm for clauses of size 2. It's a little complicated. I don't want to go into it. But what I claim is that once you get the clauses of size 3, that is where the hardness comes in, okay? That a special problem called pre-satisfiability says I give as input a set of clauses where every clause contains at least 3 literals. And it's not at least 3, but exactly 3 literals, okay? And I have to ask, is there a way to set it so that every clause is satisfied? This is what I mean by pre-satisfiability. Okay, any questions about the pre-satisfiability problem? Okay, what I want to now do is prove to you that pre-satisfiability is every bit as hard as general satisfiability. Okay, any questions? How would I do that?
I would go back to my slide here. And I would say, actually, I can flip this up.
You really want me to say satisfiability here okay, if I can come up with a translation where I take a general satisfiability instance, convert it to a satisfiability instance where every clause has length equal to 3, such that the answer to the translated instance is the same as the answer to the original one, I have proven that 3 sat is hard. Everybody buy that logic? Okay. Any questions? So how can I do that translation? That's really the heart of what I have to do here. What if I give you, let's just try it, maybe I'll go through it, just to try as an experiment. Suppose I give you the following clause, V1, V2, let's say of length 2. Is there a way that I can translate this into some clauses such that if the clauses are of length 3, such that if this thing is true, the other one is going to be true. Okay? I don't know what the values of V1 and V2 are. Okay? Yeah? V1, not V1. If I do this, what happens? This thing is automatically satisfiable, right? So this isn't very helpful to me, is it? Okay. Suppose I did, okay, this might be an acceptable way to do it. Suppose I did V1, V1, V2. Now the clause has three its variables in it, okay? And if this is true, if there's a true here, there's a true there. Everybody agree with that? You might say, well, that's cheating. Heading it. Okay? Let me show you another way to do the same thing. What if I now did V1, V2, V, let's say, X, V1, V2, VX bar. Okay? Suppose I replace this clause of size 2. With two clauses of size 3, where they share the same two variables here and a different VX and VX prime here. Is there any way to satisfy these two without satisfying this? I claim no, right? Everybody agree with that? That if this thing is false, false. You say, oh yeah, I can make this one true, I'll just set that to be true. But what's the problem? I can't play that trick down here, right? So I can't get satisfaction for both of these unless this was satisfied, right? Everybody agree with that? So I can take, certainly, a clause of size 2 and convert it to a clause of size 3, right? What about if I gave you a clause of size 1? So what would I do with that? What would I do with that one? V1, VX, VY, Y, right? What's the next thing I would do? V1, V what? VX, not VY not. Is it true that if this thing is true, the only way I can make these two clauses true is to have V1 be true? Yeah? Right. So what happened if I said right? What happened if I said VX equal to be true, VY equals to be false? Does everybody see I'm in trouble? This is not a good translation. It did not preserve truth. Okay? There's a way for me to satisfy these two without satisfying that. Does everybody see that? So how can I make it so that that the only way to satisfy these set of clauses is to satisfy that? Yeah? Okay, so you want to do the same trick you were trying to do before, which was V1, 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 VX, 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 not VX. Okay, so that works as well as her previous trick works, which we didn't like before. Is there any way we can get around that? So what do you want to do? You want to leave it like that and get those two? Does that solve your problem? Okay, does this solve your problem? I don't think it solves your problem. What? Could add more clauses. What clauses should I add? Okay.
Four clauses. Add, too bad, add, oh, you keep that?
Well, okay, I'd like to do it because it's, okay, I'm going to make four clauses.
Okay.
And now what do you want to give me?
Vx, Vy. X, not Y. X, why not, and both of them not.
Now I claim, no matter what you do with X and Y, you are doomed to have one of these guys unsatisfied with that, right? Everybody believe that? Okay? Now I have converted V1, I have multiplied it by 4, the number of clauses. But if I take something at size n and I multiply it by 4, how big is it? It was order n before and I multiply it by 4, what do I get? Order n, that's not a lot of work, is it? Okay? So if the clause was of size 1, I could make them a set of 4 clauses of size 3. If it was of size 2, I could make 2 clauses of size 3. What if I had a clause of size 3? How do I make it into a clause of size 3? A set of clauses of size 3 that gives me the same answer. Already a size 3. So am I done, or what else do I still have to do? I need to now show you how to convert clauses of size 4, 5, ... up to n into a set of clauses of size 3. Such that the truth of that if this is satisfied, they are satisfied, and if this is not satisfied, they are not satisfied. Right? That is, I think, next class. I think we'll do that next class. But any questions about it? We still have a minute or two before class ends. Does everybody sort of see what we're doing? We are basically coming up, showing you a way to take the input and translate it. And we have to be very cunning about how we do our translation. It's not just enough to say, oh, translate it, okay? Because some translations were wrong. The property we need is that when we did the translation, the translated thing is going to be true if and only if the original thing is true. Okay? Any questions? So think about that. Look at the logic here. Because the logic is exciting but a little slippery. And we'll talk about this next class. Okay, thanks a lot.
Oh, one last thing. Hold on.